to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, Bible studies, or the Catholic Church. Today, I've invited Dr. Christopher Longhurst to a Zoom recording for a broadcast. Chris, a warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Kia ora no mai, haere mai, Beate. It's lovely to be with you again.
Dr. Christopher Longhurst is a New Zealander from Ahuriri in Hawke's Bay and a lay Catholic theologian who spent many years abroad working in Rome, Italy, and in North Africa. He is a fellow of the International Dialogue Center CAISIT, which brings religious leaders and political decision makers together to develop and implement interfaith and intercultural conflict resolution initiatives. Chris is also the leader of the New Zealand chapter of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Chris, can you tell us more about SNAP and its history?
Sure. Thanks, Beate. The word SNAP is an acronym for Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, SNAP. And we're the world's largest, oldest and most active peer support network for men and women wounded by religious authorities, institutional authorities, by priests, ministers, bishops, deacons and nuns, etc. We're independent, meaning that we are not associated with any religious organization or any other organization. And we offer a safe and confidential place for those who seek to be heard, who need support and want to be healed. And we have thousands, tens of thousands of members throughout the world. In the USA, where we were founded 30 years ago, where our international headquarters is today in Chicago. And we have chapters in Canada, throughout Europe as well, in Germany, in France, in Austria, in Spain, in Ireland, in Poland, in Switzerland, in the UK as well, and also in Australia. And we have chapters in South America, in Africa, Asia, and now in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Wow, so you're globally represented.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So just say, what you said it's a chapter, it's not a branch. Is that right?
Well, you know, we don't use the word chapter. We're a united network. And so we're all throughout the world. But SNAP in New Zealand is a charitable trust under the New Zealand Charitable Trusts Act. So we're our own independent network under the SNAP umbrella. You could call us a chapter. Part of our leadership is the executive of SNAP International, Zach Heiner. He's on the SNAP Aotearoa Trust Board. The national leader of SNAP Australia is on the New Zealand Trust Board. So we're a very strong and connected international movement. Movement as well. So chapter. It's not the best word, but I think it kind of shows the unity among the different SNAP groups nationally throughout the world under the international SNAP umbrella. We're united on so many fronts. So it could be a chapter, I guess.
Now, Chris, tell me more about the history of SNAP. You said it started in America, in Chicago.
No, actually, it started in Ohio, in Toledo, Ohio, by an American woman. Her name was Barbara Blaine in 1988. Unfortunately, Barbara was abused by a Catholic priest when she was in eighth grade in the United States by her school teacher. At the school she attended. And years later, in 88, she requested help from the Catholic Bishop of Toledo in Ohio. And she was basically ignored, sadly, and she was told that she was lying and making these things up. And she was victim-blamed, is the term we use today. So Barbara was victim-blamed in 1988. And I think it was really great because rather than being ashamed or shamed into silence, she put an ad in a local paper asking if anyone else had been abused by this priest, and three other survivors came forward, or victims came forward, and the four of them together formed the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, SNAP. That's what it was called at the time. That was in mid-1988. So she realized that survivors help each other by connecting with each other through simply reaching out in the small grassroots network in mid-1988. By the end of 1988, there was about two dozen members of the network that had grown. And by early 89, they became friends. They were contacting each other through letters and through the telephone back then. And then in 91, the first SNAP meeting was held in Chicago in a hotel. in the Holiday Inn, I think it was, in Chicago. A meeting was held, a support meeting. And then the next support meeting was in San Francisco in 1992. And the members, so let's say about 24, 30 members, were discovering a pattern. They noticed a specific pattern in the way church officials were responding to their disclosures of abuse. So in 92, they traveled to Washington, D.C., to the National Conference of Catholic Bishops in Washington, D.C., because they wanted to speak to the Catholic bishops to disclose what was happening to them when they were disclosing their abuse. But the bishops refused to see them at first. There were eventually three Catholic bishops met with the SNAP members at the time. So this, again, is in 92, and they said that they would take into consideration what they were saying. However, SNAP... either that year, 92, about 92, SNAP had its first designated listening session in New Orleans. No bishops showed up. No Catholic bishops showed up. None at all. It was kind of like when the New Zealand survivors at the Royal Commission of Inquiry last October gave their closing statements at the last hearing. There were no bishops present. All the bishops had left, so they didn't listen. They weren't listening. They weren't even present. So that happened back in 92 with SNAP. But guess who was there? The media. The media attended this listening session in New Orleans, and then the Boston Globe ran 850 stories about pedophile priests in 2002. So the numbers of victims that were coming forward to SNAP at that time were absolutely staggering. In 2003, SNAP opened up a national office in Chicago, and that's still now the National Office for the United States and the Office for the International SNAP Network in the United States. That was 2003. So since then, chapters again, or SNAP's presence has spread throughout across the United States, again into Canada, into those countries that I just mentioned. And in 2019, when I realized here in New Zealand, after I reached out to our government to request that the terms of reference for the Royal Commission of Inquiry into Abuse be extended to include faith-based care, that's when I discovered that my own story was getting taken out of my hands, and there wasn't really anyone around to support me. Even though there's some great peer support in New Zealand, like Help in Auckland, Help in Wellington, there was no one really specialized in this complexity around abuse in churches, especially abuse in faith-based organizations. So that's when I reached out to SNAP, because I knew of SNAP because of my time in the United States. And after their due diligence, after some interviews with me, they had a SNAP chapter up and running in New Zealand, based out of Wellington, in less than a month. And of course, guess who had to head it? I fell into the beautiful role of providing peer support, facilitating peer support, following the SNAP mission and values in 2019. But also, I'd just like to mention that it's not just place-based. It's also we have groups of peer support workers, for example, for men only or for women only, or for groups of specific religious backgrounds, for example, for Orthodox Christians or for Presbyterians, those abused as missionary kids, Mennonites, Lutherans. We have those who are abused in the Jewish faith tradition, those who are abused by women religious, by the Anglican and Episcopalian church, so Episcopal survivors. We have support groups for families of survivors, with their whānau. And also we have support groups for people abused as adults, Boy Scouts, and also for the rainbow community as well, especially here in New Zealand, where we have allies who provide peer support, you know, for rainbow people as well, who are often abused within their faith-based communities, especially through discrimination, manipulation, exploitation, and things like that. So it's not just child sexual abuse or physical abuse. It's religious abuse, spiritual abuse, ritual abuse, and things like that too.
It seems like it's really widespread what you just mentioned. It's been everywhere, and people have been longing for support groups, as I can hear from you. Tell me a little bit more about the definitions, because sometimes the definitions can give the first step to understand what you're doing. And so the first question I have is, sometimes I hear victims and other times survivors. So SNAP has chosen the word survivor. Is there a difference within your own definition?
We have our professional standards. We have our values, and we have our guidelines. If I can just read for you an answer to that question from our professional standards. So SNAP, first of all, SNAP refers to complainants of abuse as survivors, not complainants. So that's an important definition, I think. I know churches refer to us as complainants. So we call ourselves survivors, and we believe all survivors when we disclose the abuse. So we don't question survivors. We listen and we support survivors, and we tend to use the word survivor. And we distinguish between primary, secondary, and tertiary survivors. So a primary survivor is a person who was directly abused, whether it be sexual abuse, physical abuse, institutional abuse, etc., emotional, psychological abuse. They're survivors of that abuse. Secondary survivors are those directly affected by the abuse. For example, their family members, their whānau, their partners, their children, their siblings, even their work colleagues who are, especially in institutional abuse like churches, where there might be victim blaming, where people might hear about the abuse, especially if the victim is an employee of the church, he or she may be victim blamed. So there's an effect on those persons too, who we call secondary survivors. But also there's tertiary survivors in the broader context, members of the local community, and effectively all of us who are touched in some way indirectly. So this includes not only members of the faith-based institutions, but members of the local community. So we refer to them as tertiary survivors. We tend to reserve the word victim for someone who sadly who is no longer with us, someone who succumbed to the abuse, and someone who, unfortunately, most sadly and shockingly, ended their life. Those persons are indeed victims, because anyone who is alive and struggling with the abuse is surviving. And SNAP's work is to connect those people, empower those people to heal themselves, so they are survivors. Unless a person wants to disclose or identify as a victim themselves, we respect that, of course. The power is in their hands. And the beauty about SNAP is that we try to empower victims to represent themselves, to lead their own paths to healing through supporting them. That's all. So again, to sum up your question, we are not complainants. We reject the use of the term a complainant. I know, for example, the Catholic Church redress system identifies us as a complainant. I understand why, but we do not accept that term. We are survivors. We are people speaking out. If we have those of us, I have classmates from school, from both my intermediate school, sadly, St. Patrick's School in Riverbend Road, Napier, and St. John's College in Hastings. I have class members from those times who took their lives, sadly, and we know that they were abused. My classmates know what happened to us, and some of them are no longer with us today. They are victims. They are victims. That's why we tie ribbons on fences for them regarding the beautiful loud fence movement. But we are survivors, and why we're touching on this, you know, if I may, Beate, we advocate that there is only dignity in surviving. There is no shame. On the contrary, there's dignity in surviving, and there's a courage in speaking out about it. So I think those terms are important. Primary survivors, secondary survivors, tertiary survivors, victims and complainants, and of course our advocates. We have many people who support us who are not primary survivors. They were not abused themselves. We have one member whose husband was abused, whose son was abused, and whose brother was abused. One member. But she is the active member of SNAP. So she would be, of course, a secondary survivor. And in some senses, victimized as well. So, of course, we have experts who are trauma-informed and legally informed who work with us as well. Because on the ground, we are simply survivors leading peer support networks, bringing survivors together, showing they're not alone, and giving them a comfortable, safe, and confidential space to disclose their abuse, therefore to be heard and listened and, most importantly, believed.
That sounds really important, and thank you very much for clarifying victim and complainant and survivor, and you also touched on the different types of abuse: emotional, spiritual, physical, sexual abuse. And I think that's important so that we know what we are talking about. The other thing, what came to my mind also when we're talking about abuse and church, well, with the church being involved or people who represent the church, we often hear about people who have been complaining about abuse, well, complaining, not complaining, but have been disclosing their abuses, but they're not taken seriously. Sometimes that takes years. But also sometimes the abuser might have had two faces, so that people who could have stepped in didn't want to believe the accusations. So from your experience, how would you like someone to react who has trouble believing what they hear?
There needs to be a conversation. Where are they hearing it and how is it being heard? I know that there are people around me today, even members of the church, I'm still connected to the church, who don't believe, say that this is a witch hunt, even by the media. I think that's a very irresponsible and naive response. However, on one level, it's understandable because there is shame and there is denial. And unfortunately, the people who are denying it are the people who are actually ashamed. But the shame is not necessarily theirs in the sense that it is shame for what has happened, but part of the shame is covering it up and denying it because of the shame. It's kind of like a child. You know, when the child is ashamed and the mother tells the child off, what does the child automatically do? The child looks away. So that looking down is a response of shame. That's how some people are responding. It betrays them, sadly, because it shows that they are ashamed. Speaking the truth, of course, is important, and it's empowering to deal with it, because people who are denying it are actually part of the problem because they're covering it up by the denial. And I'm talking about ordinary people who don't want to admit this. It is happening today, Beate, but unfortunately it betrays those persons because there's so much evidence that this is a problem that is no longer just one or two bad apples. It's a systemic problem throughout the world based on religious cultures and religious systems. So exposing the truth, shining a light on it, I know that's hard. No one wants to hear that another priest's been raping children. No one wants to hear that. I mean, that's horrible. Horrible news. But by not hearing the truth, A, the issue doesn't get dealt with, and B, there's the possibility, actually the high probability that has been shown in the statistics and the research, that the abuser continues to abuse. Therefore, it leaves children at risk. So those who do deny and those who do not speak out are actually, in a sense, if I may use the word, they're complicit, sadly. They're inadvertently complicit. And this is based on their own teaching. If I'm referring to church people, you know, the Bible says, James says, those who fail to do the good that they should do, they sin. So actually, if I may, these people who deny abuse and do not speak out against it are sinning by their own standards. And I can say that as a Catholic theologian, because I'm as a Catholic theologian, quite competent in knowing how biblical teachings, Jesus is very simple truth and teaching is being undermined by these kinds of people too.
Chris, what does SNAP really want to achieve, or what does SNAP achieve with its work? Because you were mentioning about the support groups, and that people are taken seriously, that people are heard, that people are supportive and doing advocacy work, so that there is no complicity. But what is the goal, or what is what SNAP has achieved so far in these 35 years?
Sure, thanks for that, Beate. You know, I can say that SNAP is saving lives. Barbara Blaine has saved so many lives. So SNAP has a fourfold mission, and our primary mission, our primary goal, what we want to achieve is healing for victims and survivors of abuse. That's our number one mission, to support survivors so that they can heal, they can recover from the abuse and live good lives, be happy. We support survivors. That's our primary work, to support survivors. But we also work to protect children and vulnerable people and people at risk. We want to achieve the exposure of predation. So therefore, we work with the press, and part of our mission is to expose the truth. And we want to expose predators and those who shield them. And we want to raise awareness by working with the media to uncover the truth, which is part of our mission. So the way we support survivors is through conversations, through email and general support with a telephone line, and by running peer support group meetings, both face-to-face and online. And we have regional volunteer SNAP peer support facilitators across the country who provide group support or one-on-one support. We work with the Royal Commission of Inquiry. We're a core participant in the Royal Commission of Inquiry. We protect children and vulnerable people by advocating for stronger laws, for change in laws like the New Zealand Orangatambariki Act of 1989 that does not require mandatory reporting of abuse. It does not require it. So we advocate for the change in laws like that. We advocate for the change in laws like the 1997 Roman Catholic Bishops Empowerment Act, which constitutes Roman Catholic bishops as corporate souls, where they have too much power. That power leads to cover up and abuse, which we have evidence with the Royal Commission. So we want to change acts like that. So we advocate for reform and for other laws that limit criminal prosecution and civil responsibility for abusers. So, you know, we want to work to expose the truth too. We want to achieve exposing the truth. So we do that by disclosing our stories and empowering others to confront the truth too. In a safe way too, remember, because it's a process. We educate ourselves and we want to educate the public through social media, through our team of experts in their various fields, again, legal or trauma-informed therapy or counselling. So we want to educate ourselves and our communities about the effects of abuse, and we try to speak as a unified voice to bring about change by exposing the actions of clergy abuse, of religious ministers, etc. Basically, to answer your question, you know, together we find healthy ways to recover and to heal and provide a safer and better place for children and society.
I think that's a really important point, that it's about the healing, but also about preventing.
Absolutely. And that can only be done through exposure of the abuse and by speaking out against it in a responsible and effective way.
But how can we prevent the public from generalizing any issue regarding the abuse cases and then blame those priests or religious who have lived their lives in integrity? Because they are going to be blamed also, even though they are innocent. What can we do in this case?
Talking about, for example, if I can use the New Zealand statistics, according to the Royal Commission, there are about 14% of the clergy that have been accused, 14%. So there's about 85% out there that haven't been accused. We do believe the numbers are much higher. So these, of course, are only the cases that have been reported. But we know based on metric systems and forensic analysis that there are many, many cases that have not been reported. Actually, for every one case that's reported, about 5 to 8 go unreported. So we can imagine how staggering the numbers are of abuse cases. But let's say, to answer your question, it's quite simple. Church authorities need to publicly name the accused. Church authorities who are responsible, who are the relative responsible authorities for the abuse that has occurred under their watch, they need to name those people who have been accused. Because ironically, church leaders do a grave disservice to not only the public, but also to themselves and to their priests and communities by not naming the accused, their abusers. Because when they don't, unfortunately, as you've just said, this results in every priest being mistrusted and every priest being suspected as a possible abuser. So if they name the accused, we know who the accused is. That's all. The person is accused. Good priests get smeared with the possibility of being abusers when the church leaders themselves, the bishops, do not name the accused or credible cases of abuse. In the Catholic Church, unfortunately, there's a process of such secrecy and concealment around the process of disclosure that priests of goodwill end up being smeared by this secrecy. So church authorities simply need to identify their accused abusers. SNAP advocates for public lists of all the accused. And of course, if the accused have not been found guilty, then of course the public has a right to know that too. So according to natural justice, the public has a right to know that the complaint has not been upheld or whatever. Until the bishops are proactive in not hiding the complaints and they name the accused, then all priests are sadly going, their good name is going to be smeared. So the power is in their hands.
Thank you, Chris. You mentioned earlier also the loud fence movement. Can you say in a couple of words what that is?
Loud fence, as you can think about it as a metaphor for a speaking fence. It's a form of peaceful speaking out, and it's also a memorial to survivors. It began in Ballarat, which is ground zero for abuse in Australia. It began in Ballarat in 2015 when a group of survivors tied ribbons to a fence in Ballarat. And they wrote on the ribbons, beautiful coloured ribbons. They wrote things like, no more silence, speak out against abuse. So No More Silence became synonymous with what became known as the Loud Fence Movement. Again, it's a peaceful speaking out by acknowledging the abuse, usually where it occurred, which is at a school, though sometimes it can be confronting to tie ribbons on school fences unless the local community has been educated, the children have been educated, it's been explained to them what the ribbons represent, that it's for their safety. Unfortunately, here in New Zealand, we have school principals who are refusing to cooperate with the Loud Fence Movement. However, some of the bishops have been supportive of this movement. So now we have in New Zealand, which is quite ironic, we have some parishes who are supporting the Loud Fence Movement, so it's not becoming a conflict between the survivors and the local parishes. So there's a Loud Fence in Napier, in Auckland, in Wellington, several in Wellington, in the South Island too. So they can be seen across New Zealand today and around the world. And oftentimes you'll also see, even though it's a part of the Loud Fence Movement, you'll see ribbons tied on gates and on trestles, on letterboxes even, in support of survivors. It's a silent, peaceful way of speaking out rather than doing those things that are technically classified as vandalism, like graffiti a church.
Thank you, Chris. We're coming to the end of the interview, but I still want to ask you one last question. Can you say something about when somebody gets in touch with you? We can put the link, the website link, on our website. And what happens when somebody gets in touch with you? How is the process? If you can say that in a very few words, please.
Sure, indeed. And it depends on why they're getting in contact with us, because so many people contact us, not just survivors. But you know who are contacting us today? Sadly, it's not survivors, it's the parents. Parents, it's the mothers of their children who are disclosing to them, and it's the mothers that are contacting us today. This is quite sad because it's the mothers who are wanting a place to go to talk about and get support. So let's say that they are survivors too, they're victims too. So we have a telephone line. We have different people who man the line. We have a protocol for the first contact. We listen. Because most people just want to disclose. They want to be heard and they want to believe. SNAP has credibility and therefore trust when people call that line. And we offer support. That support could be connecting the caller with other survivors in their local community, or it could be connecting them with more professional support, for example, counselling or the police to make a disclosure. And we offer to support that process. So some appropriate initial responses are saying things like, you're not alone, you deserve to be heard and protected. You deserve to be safe. I'm sorry that this happened to you. We thank them for telling us their disclosure. We thank them for their courage. We ask how they would like us to help them. And we tell them that we are here for them and that we will support them. And we invite them to attend a SNAP support meeting. We mention things like it's not their fault and that they're not alone. Because the most important thing is that they feel that their sons and daughters may have been the only ones. So in the disclosure of abuse, this is very important because sometimes police will not investigate if the accused has been accused once. We do encourage them to go to the police. These acts are criminal acts usually. They have a right to justice. And we also, SNAP also has some very useful resources for survivors and survivor advocates on our website. So we invite them to also go to our website to look at resources there too. But the primary way of responding and the beginning of the relationship that hopefully will build, because some people don't connect a second time for whatever reasons. Some people, the initial disclosure begins the process. So be gentle for anyone who's listened to this interview. Please know that you will be taken very, very seriously. You will be believed and you will be supported, encouraged to heal. Because SNAP members know that in supporting other people, we actually heal ourselves.
Yes.
We actually heal ourselves by supporting others. And we can all testify to that throughout the SNAP network.
Thank you so much, Chris. And this has been really important, I think, that we clarify a few things. And as you said, you are a theologian. It's nothing against the church. It's in favor of people who have been hurt and also to protect those in the church who
Absolutely.
Are innocent.
Of and course.
So that they are not all put in one pot. And
Indeed.
So, yes, as a theologian, you're going to join us for Titipona Study and Joy on the 1st of April. And that will be about creation, the creation story, and Adam for Creator Fano. And so we'll look forward to this session. It will be 1st of April. That's a Saturday. And we'll have a morning session. So it's from 9 o'clock to 10:30 in the morning. And I wish you all the best. Thank you, Chris. And
kia ora.
Keep safe and keep up the good work.